It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Dane County has been sending more troubled children out of state for treatment. We'll learn why in just a bit.
First, the national political scene is still reacting to yesterday's surprise firing of FBI Director James Comey.
Comey has been surrounded by controversy over the last year, especially after he launched a probe into Hillary Clinton's emails shortly before Election Day, and he was in the midst of a sensitive investigation into Russian interference in last year's presidential election.
Garrett Graff is a journalist who has been covering James Comey. He's also the author of a book that looks at the history of the FBI called The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War. Garrett, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the White House. What was their rationale for the firing of James Comey yesterday?
Well, this is the big mystery today. The written rationale, the one that was delivered by Donald Trump's longtime bodyguard to FBI headquarters last night, was that James Comey had lost the confidence of the American public through his politicization of the Hillary Clinton email scandal last summer. Now, of course, that could be in some ways true, and we have indications that it is, but at the same time, the timing seems to be very suspicious that firing comes just days after Jim Comey confirmed for the first time publicly that his agency was investigating Donald Trump's campaign and possible collusion with Russia. And certainly they are investigating, we know, Russia's meddling in the election last year that aided Donald Trump. But what we also are beginning to understand and learn today is that those probes may have actually been accelerating, that there seems to be some indication today that Jim Comey might have in recent days asked the Justice Department for more staff to expand and speed up these probes.
And that's been
the timing that makes people very suspicious today.
That aspect has been disputed today, right? There are some that say he did ask for these extra resources for the investigation, and others inside the Justice Department saying, no, he didn't.
That's true. The independent reporting is saying that he asked for these resources. The Justice Department is denying it, but it's unclear whether the Justice Department is blanket denying it or whether there is some parsing of their denial that maybe that they are saying, for instance, that he didn't ask for more money, but that maybe what he asked for were more agents.
We had some breaking news this afternoon, too. Comey got a bipartisan invite to testify before the Senate. So what does that seem to say about how other lawmakers are seeing his dismissal?
The Democrats obviously have been outraged since last night. Republicans have been a little bit slower to weigh in forcefully one way or another. And certainly, I think we will begin, we are still in the early stages of this crisis unfolding, and in some ways we will not really have a better understanding of the trajectory of it until we may see, for instance, Donald Trump name a FBI director nominee in the hours or days ahead. You know, there's a chance that he might actually name someone like a Merrick Garland or a Ken Weinstein, respected longtime prosecutors and Justice Department officials who might be able to continue the independence of the FBI. But if he names someone like Rudy Giuliani or Chris Christie, that would continue to raise and worsen fears that this is an attempt to politicize the FBI under Donald Trump's loyalty.
And President Trump was asked at a news conference today about that firing, and here's what he said.
Appreciate it. Why did you fire Director Comey? Why did you fire Director Comey?
Because he wasn't doing a good job, very simply. He was not doing a good job.
We're talking right now with Garrett Graff, looking at the recent firing from yesterday of FBI Director James Comey. Garrett Graff is a journalist and the author of the book, The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War. And Garrett, looking at the options on the table going forward, you mentioned that we could see a nomination for a new FBI director soon. Where does that leave Congress?
So Congress has several different sets of tools at its disposal here. As you mentioned, they have invited Jim Comey to speak. There are probes into some of the same territory that the FBI is currently investigating, underway both at the House Intelligence Committee and in the Senate Intelligence Committee. And Mark Warner, the Democratic senator from Virginia, who is helping to lead that Senate probe, has been calling for a special counsel to be named to help lead this investigation into Russia and the Trump campaign, independent of any Justice Department interference.
And looking at some of the reaction yesterday, the Deputy White House Press Secretary yesterday suggested that maybe it was time to move on from the investigation. She said there was, quote, nothing there. So how does the firing of Comey advance that just move on already maybe narrative from the White House?
I think it doesn't in any way. And in fact, the fact that they are talking about that undermines in some way the very idea that they are advancing of why they fired Jim Comey in the first place. They're trying to sort of simultaneously say, this firing of Jim Comey had nothing at all to do with Russia, but now that Jim Comey's out of the way, let's get rid of the Russia thing. And you can't really hold both of those thoughts together in your mind at the same time.
The timeline and the evolving shape of opinion with President Trump toward James Comey is part of what's at issue here. And White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said a week ago that the president had confidence in his FBI director. What do we know about what's happened since then?
Well, this is getting back to your question about the suspicions of the timing, which is that the justification that the Trump administration gave yesterday for firing Jim Comey was all about a series of events that unfolded between July and October last year. And it doesn't seem at all clear that there is any information that we know about that time period and the decisions that Jim Comey made around Hillary Clinton's email investigation that is new within the last couple of days. What we do know is new within the last couple of days is a lot about the FBI's investigation into the Trump campaign in Russia. So that's where people are beginning to wonder, because if Donald Trump had really lost confidence in the way that James Comey handled the Clinton email investigation, it would seem likely that he would have moved sooner or faster to get rid and replace James Comey.
Reportedly, the White House, President Trump, was surprised at the reaction this firing took. He was apparently the president expecting there to be, well, maybe if not applause, there to be some support, bipartisan support for this. Why do you think the White House was caught flat-footed on that?
This is an administration that does not have very many people in its inner circle who understand the ways of Washington. There are not sort of old Washington hands in the upper rungs of this administration, and certainly not within the inner circle of the president. And anyone in Washington could have told you that firing the FBI director was not to be taken lightly, and that it was going to create a political firestorm, particularly in the sort of ham-handed way that it was done yesterday. I mean, this is a longtime respected public servant, the leader of the nation's most prestigious and most storied law enforcement agency. And the White House didn't even understand where in the United States he was yesterday. They dispatched the letter firing him without any notice to the FBI headquarters without understanding that FBI Director Comey was actually in Los Angeles, where he learned of his firing while watching television.
We're talking to Garrett Graff right now, journalist and historian. He focuses on the FBI, and we're talking about the president's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision, of the president's decision to fire the FBI director? Do you think it was a good move? Do you think it was a politically motivated move? Does this change how you see the FBI, the American intelligence community, and the ongoing investigation into Russian involvement in last year's presidential election? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up the conversation with journalist and historian Garrett Graff, and we're looking at what led to the firing of FBI Director James Comey.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think President Trump made the right call by firing James Comey? Do you think he made the right call by doing it yesterday? Do you think Comey did a good job as FBI director? What do you think of his role, wanted or not, in the presidential election last year? And what about the ongoing investigation of Russian interference in that election? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Richard on the line with us from Milwaukee. Richard, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. No, I think it was a very ill-advised decision, and I wonder how insulated the president is to make such a decision like that of such great importance, without much consultation and the people around him. And also, I find it more than a bit ironic that Comey, being one of the main officials who's trying to help keep terrorism out of the United States, and President Trump, of course, being very strongly behind an anti-terrorist agenda, that President Trump would let go of a man who is the point man on that issue.
Richard, thank you for calling. Appreciate your thoughts there. And a couple of points there, Garrett. Starting with the first one, he says he seems to see a president who's pretty isolated in the White House. Do you see that same sort of indication based on this move?
Yes, and we certainly saw that last night, where this firing, as I was saying, was conducted with a minimum of foresight and planning. Most senior officials were not aware that this was in the works at all. And so their response was very flat-footed. And, you know, Donald Trump took to Twitter last night to mock Chuck Schumer, which, if that's the entirety of the communications plan for one of the most momentous acts that you can take as a president, then, you know, you are definitely underestimating what the firestorm is going to be.
You mentioned a communications plan, and there are some indications, some reporting that there wasn't one, or at least that it was thrown together on the fly. I read reports this morning of Sean Spicer huddling in bushes, trying to come up with things, talking to reporters in the dark. So can you speak to the communications aspect of this?
It was a disaster last night, and that was largely because there was no planning that appeared to have gone into this. And it's not even entirely clear how much of the White House's timeline should be trusted. They have been saying that the Deputy Attorney General initiated this review of his own accord when he took office, but there's a reporting today that makes it appear that actually Donald Trump decided to do this and then asked for legal justification from the Justice Department to do it, which in its own way would actually be a very interesting counterpoint to when in 2004, then Deputy Attorney General Jim Comey faced down the White House over an NSA surveillance program in one of the most dramatic moments that we've seen in U.S. government in up until yesterday. And that was really the moment that Jim Comey created this aura of independence that helped land him the nomination by President Barack Obama to be FBI director in 2013.
What did you think of the Deputy Attorney General's letter that went public, this memo that was went on to form the basis of this firing, at least part of it? Did it seem like a document that had been prepared for a while, that had been gathering evidence, or what did it look like to you?
There are a couple of different things that stand out for me in that memo. The first is, it's undeniably true. Jim Comey has been increasingly isolated himself over the last year. He has angered many longtime Bureau, Justice Department, White House figures over the last year, and has left people on both sides of the aisle very unhappy as he has waded into this political morass with the FBI. And that is not the role of the FBI director. I said in my Politico magazine piece on Comey's firing last night that Jim Comey has forgotten one of the fundamental tenets of Washington politics, which is that in Washington, FBI directors should be like children, seen and not heard. All of that said, it doesn't seem like the memo from the Deputy Attorney General that was released yesterday had any real justification for why Jim Comey needed to be fired on short notice with no planning yesterday afternoon. And that's where this whole thing begins to get really messy, is if that was the real reason that you had lost confidence in Jim Comey, and it's entirely possible, for instance, that a President Hillary Clinton today could have made the same decision about Jim Comey in that regard, I don't really understand what transpired yesterday that makes this so urgent and so necessary to get Jim Comey out of office, unless there's some other motive at play. And that's what many people suspect today regarding the Russia probe.
We're talking with Garrett Graff right now, journalist and author of the book, The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War. It's a history of the FBI. And we're looking at the political fallout around the firing of FBI Director James Comey. And we'll take another call now. We've got Anne joining us in Green Bay. Anne, hi.
Hello. Well, most of the time when you fire somebody, don't you usually bring them into your office and do that privately? I think the way that Trump went about this was very cowardly, raises even more suspicion. And I personally have called both my senators and my congressmen and asked them to put forth an independent investigation into this, because I think this is far from over.
And thank you for that. And Garrett, what do you say?
Yeah, this is sort of one of the amusing ironies that we are learning about Donald Trump as president, is that for a man who probably would not be in this office today except for The Apprentice television show, where he was famous for dramatically firing someone at the end of every episode, he does not actually appear to enjoy firing people in real life, and that in almost every instance that we have seen like this, he has not confronted that person personally and instead dispatched deputies and done it remotely.
And thank you so much for that call. And Garrett, I want to ask you, you wrote an in-depth piece for Politico magazine about Comey. What kind of figure would you say he was compared to other FBI directors?
So Jim Comey stepped into the FBI in 2013 after the longest serving FBI director since J. Edgar Hoover himself, Robert Mueller, who led the FBI through 12 years of really wrenching organizational change to refocus that agency around counterterrorism and international threats. Jim Comey, by contrast, he's a towering figure. He stands 6'8" and is a religion major from the College of William and Mary. He's deeply philosophical, a big fan of the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. And he was an incredibly popular FBI director within the rank and file, very casual, utmost integrity, and certainly someone that up until last year had been seen as a very beloved figure within the FBI. That said, all throughout his tenure as FBI director, he has been very aggressively, as I said last night, biting the hand that feeds him. He has picked very public fights with people like the Apple CEO Tim Cook over surveillance and encryption. He picked public fights with Barack Obama's White House and the Justice Department over what he called the Ferguson effect, the effect of police officers who, in the wake of protests in Ferguson and the Black Lives Matter movement, were beginning to slow down and not do their jobs as thoroughly. And sort of throughout his his career has been very oppositional to whatever the power is that he is aligned against. And that is something that I think probably worried those around Donald Trump, that Jim Comey had something to prove right now, that he was in fact deeply independent from Donald Trump.
So you have a sitting FBI director, popular by some measures, who some people saw as quite independent. He's fired on short notice. He finds out on TV. What does this do to morale at the agency and to any cooperative spirit in the agency to work with, for example, the White House?
Everything that I have heard is that this is pretty devastating within the FBI, that agents are very upset. And remember, the investigation itself is taking place at a lower level, and so all of those people are, presumably quite renewed and fired up about this probe today. And it's worth remembering that Mark Felt, the person who became the famous deep throat figure during the Watergate scandals, was a disaffected FBI agent who, unhappy at the internal politics of the FBI and unhappy with what he saw as the high crimes and misdemeanors of the Nixon White House, helped to bring President Nixon down. The FBI can be a very powerful enemy if it wants to be.
Well, as we wrap up, Garrett, this is obviously very complicated and it's a story that has to unfold quite a bit as we go along. But what are you watching for? What signals are going to tell you which way the wind is blowing?
So two things I think to watch for immediately is, what does the Republican Congress do? A lot of this stands in their hands. Do they begin to turn on President Trump? Do they call for hearings? The second thing that to watch for is, as I mentioned, who does Donald Trump pick as a nominee next? Does he pick a respected bipartisan, nonpartisan, independent figure like a Ken Weinstein or a Merrick Garland or even a Fran Townsend? Or does he pick someone who would be seen as a sort of loyalist to Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, or Chris Christie, or even your famous Milwaukee sheriff?
And we leave it there. Garrett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
This is Garrett Graff, journalist and author of the book that looks at the history of the FBI. It's called The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War.
Several counties in Wisconsin are sending some troubled kids out of the state in order to get them the help that they need to treat and address trauma that they experienced at a young age, along with serious mental health issues.
For the most part, these children are being sent away to states like Indiana and Ohio because Wisconsin doesn't have the facilities to treat them.
Jessie Opoyan joins us now. She's a reporter for the Capital Times, where she covers politics and government. She wrote a piece investigating this trend. Jessie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
How did this issue of kids being sent out of state come to your attention in the first place?
I was actually just talking with some folks who are involved in county government here in Dane County, who the issue had been raised to them through some of the committees that they work on. And it's a relatively new issue for Dane County. And I found out from there that it's actually become more of a statewide thing, too.
Can you talk about the kids who are being sent out of state? What kind of conditions are they facing that have led them here?
Yeah, it's the kids in particular. It's a complex set of factors that have led to this being a thing in the first place. But then the kids themselves, most of them are they've experienced some form of trauma growing up, usually multiple instances of that. So it may be abuse or witnessing abuse over many years. They typically don't have very strong coping skills to deal with that, and usually have sort of impulsive reactionary behavior. They're usually considered to be a danger to themselves or to others. Basically, just really complex needs that there either aren't facilities here in Wisconsin that can deal with them adequately, or those facilities that do exist are full and can't take additional kids on.
Right. With all that, these are not kids who would get an ordinary foster home placement, for example.
Generally, no. And it's sort of, there's a lot of interconnectedness here. So it sort of goes up a chain, right? If the kid has lower level needs, maybe some sort of treatment in the community that even keeps them in the home. And if that's not an option, you'd go up to foster care. Then you'd go up to a a group home, and then you would go from there to a residential care center. Obviously, kids with more challenging behavior, you'd kind of jump up a couple steps and maybe go straight to those RCCs. But yeah, generally speaking, we're not talking about kids that would be able to stay in their homes or go to a foster home.
What's the age range we're talking about?
It's all ages, but the five, now six actually in Dane County, we're all ages 12 and 13. I think that's fairly typical, but it does sort of span across the adolescent ages.
And you write that you focused on Dane County in your piece. This isn't just about Dane County.
It's not just Dane County. It's really statewide. In fact, Dane County is sort of in the middle in terms of this, and it can change on any given day or month, you know, what the makeup is of this. But it is, the state last sort of took a picture of this in November of 2016, and at that time there were 29 kids throughout the state who were in other states.
And what states are they in?
They're all over. The ones from Dane County were in Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Oklahoma. There are those are pretty popular states for the whole statewide group. But you know, there are kids as far as Tennessee and Arkansas too, from throughout the state.
Now, you talked to, as you mentioned, county officials, people who work in mental health, children's welfare, things like that. Nobody, it seems like, thinks this is the right answer. Nobody wants to be sending these kids facing these serious issues to another state, further away from their communities. Everybody agrees that's not where we want to be.
Yeah, everyone involved here agrees this is not ideal for a number of reasons. One being, it's just harder to treat kids who are not close by. So, you know, you've got things like video conferencing that can help, but the social workers who work with these children need to be in touch with them, need to have face-to-face contact. So at that point, you know, you're having to fly workers to other states. There's a cost involved with that, but more than that, I think people are concerned that the kids just can't be monitored as closely. It's harder for families to go visit, and that's an important part. You want to, that generally you're trying to get kids so you can bring them back to their homes eventually. And if the families can't be part of that ongoing treatment, then it's just more difficult to make that happen.
There's family counseling ideally involved, and that's hard to do if it's in Oklahoma and
exactly.
The families in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
How, and you said this was a complicated story, but how do we end up here? It sounds like this wasn't, in a way, it's not a bad thing that we ended up here. A lot of good things have happened that led to these kids, in a way, falling through the cracks.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, one of the people that I spoke with said it's really the result of doing things right rather than doing things wrong. But it's a lot of different factors. One, fewer children are being arrested. That arrest rate's gone down from, I think, by about 53% from 2005 to 2014, the number of kids just being arrested in the state. Beyond that, there's more of a focus on trying to keep kids in their community and find options to even keep them in their homes before you look at anything related to corrections. In addition to that, there's been some adjustments over the years to the reimbursement rates that some of these facilities can charge. At the time, that was welcomed by the counties and the state. Now they're wondering if maybe that's caused too much downsizing and led to some diminished capacity. You're also seeing one of the negatives, though, that's contributed is people said that they are seeing more challenging behaviors in a smaller sort of subset of kids, just diagnoses that weren't that common 25 years ago, seeing kids with forms of psychosis, you know, bipolar disorder, things that are just more of a challenge to deal with.
And one weird outcome, you mentioned the lower reimbursement rates. It sounds like we've got a situation where that limit applies in-state. So you might have a facility that could take one of these kids, but because they can charge more out of state, there might be a kid coming into the state from out of state and then the kid from Wisconsin having to go somewhere else because that spot is taken.
Yeah, it's like a giant jigsaw puzzle. So like you said, the reimbursement rates generally only apply to kids in state. So if you've got X amount of beds and you are reimbursed by, you know, the number of kids that you have filling those beds, you want to fill them and you're going to take a kid from, you know, wherever they can come from. And it'll be easier for you to keep your doors open if you can charge more and take a kid from out of state. And of course, now we've got Wisconsin's kids in other states and other states' kids in Wisconsin, sort of creating this hodgepodge situation. But, you know, some people have talked about maybe moving away from that per bed style reimbursement situation, just so that maybe some of these facilities could keep some beds open for when those higher needs do arise.
Talking to Jesse O'Poyan from the Capital Times about a group of kids, 20-some kids from Wisconsin being placed for treatment out of state or out of the state elsewhere in the country, and efforts to provide resources for them here in Wisconsin. And let's get to that, Jesse. What are people talking about for solutions?
There are a lot of discussions happening right now. There's some discussions within different counties. There's some counties that are partnering, and the state's sort of keeping an eye on all of this. So some of the things that they're talking about is what I just mentioned, adjusting that payment model so that it's easier for some of these facilities that can treat those more challenging behaviors to keep some spaces open for when those do come up. Looking at earlier intervention services, going into schools, trying to catch some of these behaviors before they turn into anything getting close to dangerous or criminal, but providing counseling, working with families at an earlier age, adjusting some of they call them wraparound services, but again, those services that can be provided to kids while they stay in their home, in their community, bringing counselors in to work with parents and set up a system. And also, the thing that I heard, I think, more than anything was there's still, although we're talking about this higher level of residential care centers, there's a need for more foster parents and a need for foster parents who are willing and able to put up with some of these really challenging behaviors and stick with it in the long haul. And, maybe that involves more incentives for recruitment and retention for those parents to make it easier for them. But if you can have a strong foster system, you can focus more energy and resources on the higher up the ladder too.
Is part of the story here that maybe these are kids once upon a time that would have been in the youth corrections system as opposed to mental health systems?
It is. And, one of the things that a theory that I heard initially when I was pursuing this story is maybe some of the issues that we've heard about over the last few years at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, maybe that was contributing to this crunch. And actually, that's the opposite is true. That has played a very small part in it because there's been a shift over the last few years, last couple decades, really toward trying to divert kids away from corrections. And so, yeah, where you would have seen these kids going into an institution like that, there's much more of a preference to try to get them somewhere else.
So these are solutions that might be down the road for the most part. You've mentioned some of this, but let's get into it a little more. What kind of things are we doing now to do the best we can for the kids who are in Illinois, Michigan, Oklahoma, wherever?
Yeah. One of the judges that I interviewed said that whenever she has to place a kid out of state, she makes sure to set up more frequent reviews just to make sure that things were going okay. The counties do send their social workers on visits before they place children in a facility to vet it and make sure it's going to be, the appropriate place to send that child. And then also, they do visit. They have face-to-face contact once a month. They're actually, at least in Dane County, and I don't know about others, they will in some situations help families financially to go visit their kids if traveling would be a hardship, to try to assist with that. Looking sort of ahead at the long term, there are a couple of these work groups that are focusing on how do we get these solutions both in the short term and in the long term.
And as we wrap up, what are you looking at next in this story?
Probably next, a couple of things. One, seeing what the recommendations are from some of these work groups. I know the State Department of Children and Families is kind of waiting for some of those to determine if there's anything that needs to be done at the state level. So I'd be watching to see if any legislation is crafted or if there are any sort of budget asks on that regard. And I think, a potential follow-up for me is I spoke with some folks who place children into foster homes last week. And that's sort of an area that I didn't get to explore in this story, but looking at the bigger picture of this system and what else needs to be changed in some of the other parts of it.
We'll leave it there for now. Jesse, thanks as always for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Jesse Apoyan is a reporter for the Capital Times, where she covers politics and government. She joined us to talk about a growing number of troubled children being sent out of state for treatment. You can read her story, by the way. We've got a link on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, a new survey conducted by the Wisconsin Professional Police Association found that communities of color in the state would like to see more policing in their communities.
This comes at a time when relations between minority communities and law enforcement can be tense nationwide. And our next guest says that just because a community wants more community policing, it doesn't mean they necessarily want more boots on the ground.
Jim Palmer joins us now. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we get into this new poll, let's talk about community policing. It's a phrase we hear a lot when we talk about police and community relationships, but what is it? What happens when a department is practicing community policing?
Well, in community policing, officers tend to be assigned to a specific area, and it really worked to develop relationships in the neighborhoods, not only with the people that live there, but with the organizations that might serve the residents there. And it really is a relationship-centered kind of policing approach, and it's one that has really grown over many years, and I think will continue to grow for many years to come.
Is this something that people are embracing wholeheartedly, or is it, like in any line of work, is this kind of a buzzword that people are latching onto?
Well, I do really think there is a great deal of appeal for this kind of policing. It personalizes officers, certainly, kind of breaks down some of those barriers that people might have when they just see a police officer's uniform and their badge, and allows people, the residents that are served by law enforcement, to see the officers as individuals. And likewise, it really helps the law enforcement officers understand the communities that they're serving. And so I really think it is a meaningful approach that's going to continue to grow.
Let's get into that new survey now. What did you learn from this survey when it comes to the public's attitudes toward community policing?
Well, Wisconsin really has been a national leader when it comes to enacting and exploring reforms and innovations for policing in the 21st century. And this is the fifth year that we've conducted a statewide poll through the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. And it's worth noting that we're the only statewide law enforcement group in the country that engages in such an effort. On the issue of community policing, what we found was that, interestingly, overall, that 58% of the respondents feel that the community level of community policing should remain the same. 37% indicated that they thought they wanted an increase. But when we kind of peeled back the cross tabs and looked more at the specific demographics of the poll, we found it interesting that amongst non-whites, 60% of those individuals wanted an increase in community policing. So to us, that was pretty instructive. It says that, minority communities don't just want more boots on the ground, but they want a certain type of policing, and that's something that the law enforcement community here in Wisconsin be sensitive to.
And there's a big national conversation here in the state, too, about the relationship between police departments, police officers, and minority communities. Is community policing part of the solution to bridging the tensions that we see in a lot of communities?
I think it can go a long way to breaking down the barriers between law enforcement, the law enforcement community, and communities of color in particular. And it really that would help, I think, personalize the relationship both ways, in both directions, in a meaningful way. And I think that would make law enforcement more sensitive to the communities that they're serving, and it would make, hopefully, the residents that they're protecting, more aware of the jobs that officers have to do.
We talked yesterday to Democratic State Senator Lena Taylor. She's got a package of legislation she's working on, some of it meant to encourage community policing. She's working, she said, with Republican Senator Van Wongard on some related issues. What would you look for from the governor and state lawmakers that might make community policing easier to implement, more effective?
Well, obviously, funding is always an issue in law enforcement, and so that's something we want to be sensitive to. Because at the end of the day, there needs to be an adequate response in each and every department so that they can respond to emergencies effectively and that they have the appropriate backup. I mean, over the last 3 years, we've seen some pretty significant increases in the number of officers assaulted in the line of duty. So the issue of backup is always important when officers, that they have the help when they need it, quite frankly. So that's one big thing. I think also making sure that the training is available so that community policing in one community isn't, all that different in another, and that there are some, best practices that are put to use. And I think that law enforcement in Wisconsin is very good in terms of learning from one another. So anything that we can do to improve that and reinforce that and strengthen that, I think will be helpful.
Talking to Jim Palmer with the Wisconsin Professional Police Association about police community relations and a new survey the organization just had conducted, some results out. Jim, we've focused so far on community policing. That was not the whole survey. You also ask every year about the public's attitude toward police officers. What did you find this year?
Well, and this has been these results have been consistent over the 5 years that we've been doing this poll. What we found were that the approval rating overall in Wisconsin for its police officers is very high this year at 84%. Again, looking deeper into the poll, it's revealed that there's an 88% approval rating amongst Caucasians, and minorities a 65% approval rating. So still a majority, but I think the fact that there is that disparity is again something to which the law enforcement community needs to be aware of and sensitive to.
Now, what kind of things can you do to close that gap?
Well, it really does come back to community policing in one way. And in another way, you know, we think that anything we can do as the state's largest law enforcement group to help break down those barriers and improve the criminal practices and the criminal justice practices, rather, that exist in the state, and also just to help educate the public about law enforcement and the dangerous jobs that they have. You know, another area that we asked this year, we asked some questions about people's perceptions related to the officer-involved deaths that occurred in the last year. Mm-hmm. And then we could kind of match that against the reality that we saw. So, for example, we asked, you know, how many people did they think were fatally shot by police last year? How many people did they think were armed? And, you know, while our poll showed that a significant proportion of the people, though certainly not a majority, felt that a number of unarmed individuals were shot by police last year. In fact, 100% of the fatal police shootings did involve armed subjects. So that's, we think, a helpful distinction for us to make. And we also asked to what extent people had a sense about the race of the people that law enforcement officers were shooting. So, you know, we asked that, did they think that most people shot by police are you know, Black, African American, or some other members of some other minority group? And again, there were significant proportions of our respondents that indicated that although, again, not a majority, that there were minorities that represented the majority of those fatally shot by police. When in fact, 70% of the individuals were white. And so, again, we're trying to do our part on multiple fronts to just help educate the public and frankly, educate the law enforcement community as well.
Those police-involved deaths are obviously one of the things that have gotten the most attention in the national media. Are there things you think police departments can do, are doing, to reduce the risk of those situations whenever possible?
Absolutely. Again, this is where I think Wisconsin really has been ahead of the curve over the last several years. There really has been more of an emphasis on de-escalation, training, and tactics that utilize less lethal forms of force. But, you know, even if you look at many of the cases that involved fatal shootings last year, they involved, you know, cases where the officers did attempt to use less lethal force first, and they were unfortunately ineffective.
And as we wrap up, Jim, I wanted to ask about, there's been a call from some state lawmakers to take that investigation law of police shootings, change it a little more to try to make sure people doing the investigation have as little contact as possible, or a little connection, I should say, as possible with the police department involved. Do you think that investigation law needs to change?
Well, we think the investigation law, which, as you know, is the first of its kind in the country, and Wisconsin is still, even though we passed that law in 2014, we're still only one of three states in the nation that, you know, mandates the independent investigations of officer-involved deaths. So our view is that the law has worked very well, but that doesn't mean we should foreclose any opportunities to explore ways to improve it. As far as reducing conflicts of interest, perceived conflicts of interest, we think that's certainly worth exploring, but obviously the devil is in the details, and we want to make it you know, we don't want to make the law ineffective or hamstring the law. And so that will be a concern of ours as we evaluate that proposal such as that.
We'll leave it there for now. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
That was Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. He joined us to talk about a new poll from that organization and a growing interest in community policing in the state. You can share your thoughts on the topic over on the Central Time Facebook page.
TV appearances, press conferences, and now Twitter are all big parts of presidential communication these days, and the White House has a long tradition of being on the cutting edge.
On this day in 1877, 140 years ago, by my math, President Rutherford B. Hayes welcomed the first telephone into the White House.
And it was not a phone in the Oval Office, but it was in the White House telegraph room. There were not a lot of phones in the country yet. The only line with a direct connection to the White House was in the U.S. Treasury Department.
The White House phone number was 1-800-273-8255. That's it. Just one. You want it, you're in the Treasury Department. You want to call the White House telegraph room. You dial one. I like that. Really easy to remember.
I know. And so what, when they got a second line, was it two?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. And it spiraled out of control because that would be easy. Oh, was it five? No. Two? No. No, one. I'm pretty sure it was one.
Well, I mean, we hardly use phone numbers at all. I guess we have them.
Now they're programmed into our phones.
I wonder at a point when we will not have phone numbers. Now I think about numbers more in connection with internet passwords.
Oh, yeah.
So imagine if your password was one.
Well, I just like the picture of a president, like, telegraphing out their thoughts, like, a few times a day. This is Central Time celebrating famous phone numbers of history.